This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor for the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you tuning in to Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review program, and we're ready to really talk about some earth-shaking events from this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, we've launched a new version of thetrumpet.com today. It's very exciting. This has been a long process for us, but I encourage you to go there and check it out. And we're going to start the program today in Asia. There's quite a lot of tension between North Korea, Japan, the United States, China, South Korea. There's quite a lot going on over there. Missile launches that are making people nervous, missile defense systems that are making other people angry, a president being impeached on corruption charges. Stephen Fleury has been talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and shows how just this world really is primed for conflict. To bring us up to speed on what's happening over there, we're going to go straight to Jeremiah.
Yes, it really has been an exceptionally busy week on the Korean Peninsula, especially. Within a matter of hours, starting on Sunday, the region was sort of launched into a state of geopolitical unrest and instability. And I wouldn't say that a military conflict is on the immediate horizon, but there are some really, you know, ongoing tensions that involve just a whole cast of players. As you mentioned, there's North and South Korea, Japan also, China, the U.S., even Malaysia. And others are roped into this, so you could see how it could quickly escalate. And it all started on Sunday when North Korea fired 4 missiles toward Japan. It was just a test to launch, but it was illegal because of UN resolutions that outlaw North Korea's missile program. And it was a big success for the North. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, he said, quote, "The 4 ballistic rockets launched simultaneously are so accurate that they look like acrobatic flying corps in formation." And North Korea state media also said that it fired those rockets in hopes of eventually being able to hit U.S. military bases in Japan. Mm-hmm. So Kim Jong-un was very pleased, obviously. 3 of the 4 missiles ended up falling within Japan's territorial waters, which, of course, that enraged the Japanese and the Americans, set the whole region on edge, and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe immediately called U.S. President Donald Trump right after this happened, and the two of them agreed that this latest launch means the threat posed by North Korea has, quote, entered a new stage, end quote. And then just a few hours later on Tuesday, the United States abruptly announced that it had started to set up the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. This system has been on the table and kind of in the works for years. It's basically a system designed to be able to shoot down North Korean missiles before they could hit targets in, you know, South Korea, Japan, or elsewhere. But it's very controversial because Russia and China hate this system. They feel that despite what the United States may say about it being just designed to stop North Korean missiles, that it's also designed to contain their own, you know, Russian and Chinese missiles. So the controversy has kind of kept the U.S. from really setting up that THAAD system for quite a long time. But this week, the leadership gave it the green light, and it's now being assembled as we speak.
Now, it was coincidence, was it not, that this happened like within such a short time of those North Korean missile launches, or is this really viewed as a response to what North Korea did?
From what I can tell, it's being viewed as a direct response because of the launch. U.S. leadership has said, you know what, we can't fumble around on this thing anymore. It's time to start to set it up.
It's been in the works for a long time, but it's been held up basically just because of diplomatic.
Exactly. Diplomatic concerns. We've kind of been kicking the can down the road. We knew we needed it, but now we say the need for this trumps any desire to make sure that we don't ruffle the feathers of China and Russia. So it's time to go ahead with it.
Good choice of verb.
And so Russia and China are really irate about that. When China saw the THAAD system being assembled, Beijing promptly warned of a new atomic arms race with the United States. And then a few hours after that, North Korea just further rattled the region by, this is in a way unrelated, but they announced that they were blocking all Malaysians from leaving North Korean soil. This goes back to last month when Malaysia and North Korea entered into a really tense time after Kim Jong-un's half-brother was assassinated by him or his men in Malaysia. Anyway, it's led to a lot of diplomatic fallout between the two, and now Malaysians can't even leave North Korea. So that just ratcheted things up quite a lot more. And then just yesterday, in a really dramatic event, South Korea's president was taken out of office. She had been caught up in a terrible scandal, so she was impeached, and yesterday she was finally removed. And this presents some really serious potential problems for the United States, because President Park had been a real pillar of U.S. policy in Asia, which pushed for a very hard line against North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. And you know, President Park, she also would have been instrumental in allowing the THAAD system to be developed on South Korean soil. So now that she's gone, her downfall is expected to shift South Korean politics to her opposition. And the opposition leaders want a lot more engagement with North Korea and with China. They don't want to follow the United States. They say that they'll re-examine South Korea's joint strategy on North Korea with the U.S. And also that they'll try to defuse tensions with China. So reports say that President Trump in the U.S. is now just scrambling to make sure that the THAAD system is operational before President Park's replacement comes into power, which elections will take place in 59 days now. Mm. So he's really hoping to get that system up and running before then. Although even if it were up and running, there's nothing that would prevent the new leadership in South Korea from, you know, dismantling it. So anyway, it's quite a mess there. There are a lot of moving pieces, and it really just looks unlikely that that situation would be easily stabilized anytime soon. It really does look like, as you mentioned there, that it's just primed for further escalation, primed for conflict.
And yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens here over the next couple of months. We've been talking about just how this trend toward America reducing its engagement with the rest of the world would happen under a Trump administration. It's been happening under the Obama administration, but Donald Trump does seem to be fairly cozy with the Japanese prime minister anyway.
Yes.
And the way that he's handling, the way that he'll handle the situation as unstable as it is with South Korea, with North Korea making the kinds of provocative moves that it is, yeah. China obviously deeply offended by the introduction of this THAAD system. They right. feel like this gives the United States some kind of advantage over them that they're not comfortable with. There's just a lot on the U.S. president's plate, and these Asian leaders are trying to just make sense of what the region is going to be looking like going forward.
That's right. It doesn't seem like they've given him very much of a honeymoon period of tranquility or anything to get settled into office. It's very much, you know, guns blazing there, and he doesn't have much time to respond to this potentially very tumultuous situation.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. It's in the face of threats like these that we're talking about that military discussion in Europe has been intensifying, the need for a unified European military. And that discussion has increased all the more since Britain voted to exit the European Union last year. Britain's been resisting European militarization. But now it seems European leaders are acting like much more like the shackles are off. This week, the European Union states agreed to open a command center that some hope is a precursor to an EU defense headquarters. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, on Monday, they approved the creation of a new military planning and conduct capability center. And that's a bit of a mouthful.
Doesn't quite roll off the tongue.
No, and there are good reasons for that, which we'll get to in a minute. But basically, it is what people hope will be this kind of nucleus of a future European army, as the EU Observer called it. It's a military headquarters But it's only allowed to be a headquarters for non-combat missions. So European training missions in Mali, in the Central African Republic, and Somalia. Those are the three ongoing military training missions. So what this is you've got a lot of European countries that really want to get moving on having a European army, especially France and Germany. They're very keen on this. You've got others like Britain, who is still technically part of the European Union, and so there's still a few things that they can do to try and slow things down. There are some other nations in that 27-nation member state that aren't quite convinced of this EU army. And so what you've got is this bit of a messy compromise of a combat center that can't conduct combat missions. for example, there are apparently long arguments about exactly what the director would be called. They're not allowed to call him a commander. He's the director, because commander sounds a little too military for some nations' likings, especially Britain. And this kind of back and forth has led some people to write off this command center and say, okay, look, it's just more ridiculous EU muddle. But this is exactly in line with what we've seen since this kind of big push for European militaries after Britain voted for Brexit. It's something that, okay, on paper, it's not, you know, it's 30 people and it's a new headquarters and it's a bit of a jumble. Okay, there's some people saying it's underwhelming. But you look at the principle that they've established, and actually it's huge. Now we've got a lieutenant general who's in charge of European armed forces. We've got a command structure. We've got that set up. And then it's not that hard, once that's going, to scale it up. And in fact, they've already scheduled in 2018 to review it and to let this military headquarters be in charge of combat missions. And so as soon as next year, they could be reviewing it and expanding its scope. And I think really, you know, the big battle is getting it started. Mm-hmm. They've got it started, and now it's much simpler to expand it. And we've seen that with the European Border and Coast Guard Agency, where it's got massive powers. It's a massive concession, you know, European nations sharing a common border. But it starts in a very small way. But once it's begun, it's much easier to expand. So it's just another step now where they're moving towards a European military in these kind of what look like small steps, but are in principle very significant agreements.
Yeah, it really is kind of classic, based on what we've seen in several other instances, the way that Europe conducts its business, because it really does have to kind of toe the line to not raise too much alarm among those who have been concerned about the rise of militarization. Even the Austrian defense minister said, well, no, this is not a precursor to a European army. These nations don't want to give up their sovereignty and so on. There's definitely that contingent within the European project that is concerned about this. But still, with Britain out of the picture, this is definitely enabling this kind of movement to proceed.
That's right. And you just need to look at what some other people are saying about it. I think Deutsche Welle called it a military headquarters and everything but a name. The Belgian foreign minister, he said it's a first step. A European army, maybe later. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the way a lot of people see it. And again, the German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, we took a very important step towards a European security and defense union. So they're seeing it not as the end, but the first step in a journey.
Yeah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. An interesting development in Palestinian politics. For years, the Arab-Jew conflict has been at an impasse because of the Palestinians' refusal to even acknowledge the Jews' right to live in that area. We've also tracked the growing popularity of Hamas among Palestinians. This is the radical group that has quite a lot of support among Palestinians. And from its inception, this group has been completely opposed to doing any deals with Israel. It's said that the Arabs are the rightful owners of all that land. But it looks like this is changing. This week, details came out of a plan by Hamas to depart from some aspects of what have defined this organization from its beginning. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
So the Hamas Charter is something that anyone that's written about Palestinian politics in the Middle East from the Israeli point of view definitely would have noted because of how offensive it is. This is its foundational document when it broke off broke off from the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in 1988 and was based out of the Gaza Strip. They had a foundational document which had their aims and objectives, and it was clearly extremely anti-Semitic. It blamed the Jews, not just Israeli Jews, but Jews in general, for a number of acts such as starting World War II, World War I, being behind a lot of that's what Hamas was facing for a number of years, because people could point to that and say, well, that's obviously not true, but Hamas didn't care what the Jews were painted, or how they painted the Jews, at least from the beginning. Now it seems like that is changing. There is a report that came out from a Pan-Arab daily that's based in London, and it's based on a report or discussions with Hamas members, and they say that the charter, the foundational charter for, that's been the same for 29 years, is about to be amended. And that will be amended here in April after there is some type of internal election. And there are a number of substantial changes, and all of those changes, at least from these Hamas officials, look like they are trying to give themselves a cleaner image, not as ludicrous of a terrorist organization that hates every Jew, doesn't matter where you are on the planet. They are refining their goals and objectives, it seems, through this update.
So tell us some of the specifics that are reflected in this report.
So there's three that are departures from, or updates or amendments, and broad amendments. And the first is that Hamas will endorse a Palestinian state with the 1967 borders. Now, Hamas has never done this in the past because it tacitly implies that they recognize an Israeli state. If you're going to accept a certain Palestinian state in the 1967 borders, then you are next to somebody on the other side of the border.
Right.
Now, while they have said that they are not recognizing Israel's right to exist, nor Israel's statehood as a Jewish state, they will endorse a Palestinian state and the 67 borders. Now, why are they doing this? I think it's a follow-on from the United Nations Security Council resolution back last year, when the UN basically said the same thing. They said that you don't need to recognize Israel to get your own state. The West Bank, that's what it's talking about with these 1967 borders. The West Bank rightfully belongs to you Palestinians. So that is your starting point for negotiation. Hamas now says, fine. Although it does sound like Hamas is willing to make a deal if they just say that they are, you know, wanting or believe in the 1967 borders. So this is a change. It shows that they might be willing to negotiate something with Israel. The second thing that is going to come out is they're going to officially break with the Muslim Brotherhood. Like I said before, they have been tied to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. That was their mother organization. But now they are finally making a break from that, saying that they are not, they are going to separate from all foreign bodies and organizations. This is a change, again, which I believe they're making to try and paint themselves in a better light and get rid of the taint of that history, if they are going to have a push on the West to try and show them so they are, you know, a legitimate partner for peace or a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. They're not just a crazy terrorist organization like the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's another change. And then the final change is that they are taking out all the overt anti-Semitic language from it. Now, this is a big surprise in a way. If you weren't looking at the strategy behind this whole amendment. I mean, why are they amending it right now? Why are they making these changes right now? I believe they're making these changes right now so that they could cast themselves as a cleaner alternative, or have a cleaner image to the West as a alternative to the Fatah-ruled Palestinian government right now.
Which is interesting because of how much we've kind of seen momentum shift in their favor in Palestinian politics. They've certainly gained. I mean, we've had this whole election kerfuffle unfold over the last year where they were trying to, they said they were going to go ahead and stand in elections, and then Fatah put it off because they were afraid that Hamas would take over and so on. And in light of, as you mentioned, the UN Security Council resolution pointing to those 1967 borders, this really seems like a pretty dramatic shift in momentum toward Hamas claiming basically sole rulership over the Palestinians.
Well, I think it will do. You've got to, it's a toss up really as to how you get support from Palestinian people. A lot of the Palestinians have supported an armed struggle against the Israelis, and that is why they like Hamas rather than Fatah, because Fatah seems like they're in cahoots with the Israelis. The security establishment of Fatah works with the Israeli military and comes and makes arrests on Palestinians. So you could say that, well, they're kind of losing that hard-nosed image when that the Palestinians themselves probably realize that Hamas isn't going to change their strategy as far as wanting an armed takeover, but that this is purely to cast themselves out in a better light in the West so that they can be used in future negotiations with Israel. The big question of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process is, who represents the Palestinian people, and do we have a partner for peace? Who do you call to make a deal with the Israelis? Is it Fatah or is it Hamas? For up to now, it has been Fatah. And Hamas looks like they're trying to make a play for that role. And there's a lot of bodies inside Europe, a lot of nations inside Europe, that before this were willing to work with Hamas as the representative of the Palestinian people. This will only encourage Europeans to work with Hamas as a representative of the Palestinians with peace with the Israelis.
Well, I feel like there's quite a bit more to talk about with this, and especially this break with the Muslim Brotherhood. I think there's something interesting there. Something that we've been talking about, prophetically intriguing. Maybe we could table this discussion and bring it up again for next Wednesday's program, because it does seem like there's a lot of interesting factors at play in this move that Hamas is making here. But we appreciate you bringing that to us, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We have one more story before the break. Race relations in America have deteriorated in recent years. If you want an idea, though, of how bad they can get, it's worth taking a look at what is happening in South Africa. There, the politicians are far more outspoken against whites. And this week, there was quite an interesting and concerning development by the president, President Zuma, down there. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, there's been definitely a lot of concern for a number of years that South Africa would eventually follow the same path that Zimbabwe had taken and confiscate white-owned lands without any sort of compensation, leading to a lot of like the farm killings and other things like that that you just saw really take off in Zimbabwe in the 80s and 90s. And probably partially just because of how nightmarish the Zimbabwe played out, they have not taken that step in South Africa. Though there was a development this week that's looking like this is something that is seriously on the table now. At the beginning of the week, there's a Julius Malema, who's a prominent politician the Trumpets watched for a number of years, and he runs a radical Marxist group called the Economic Freedom Fighters, had given a speech saying that we are saying black people, all of us must unite so we can change the Constitution so that we can confiscate land without compensation. This is something the white man will not understand it. And his party's been known for making these comments for a number of years now, although the ruling party, the African National Congress, hasn't really gone along with it till this week, or actually, I guess, last Thursday. The president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, the leader of the National and African Congress, actually came in and backed up this sentiment, saying that the black parties of South Africa need to unite on this issue of confiscating land, and this is something they can no longer fight over. And in the short term, he's proposed a move to just do an audit of who owns the land in South Africa to kind of get a plan in place for how you'd go about doing this, which is a pretty big sea change for the African National Congress. They have not taken that standpoint for a long time. And it looks like now that the African National Congress, since the end of apartheid, has just dominated South African politics, getting 2/3 the vote, sometimes even 3/4 of the vote. Although their last municipal elections in last August, they were getting down close to 50%. They lost the control of like the city board of Johannesburg, in large part because a lot of the voters are going more towards the economic freedom fighters and these more radical parties. So,
Zuma is responding to this. We've heard this kind of rhetoric coming from Malema for quite some time, but you can see the pressure on Zuma is to try to become more radical in order to claim some of these supporters.
Right, because Malema was originally actually part of the African National Congress, and then they kicked him out because they thought his views were too extreme, mm-hmm. although now he's polling with like 10% of the electorate behind him, so Zuma's realizing that it's not something that he can just ignore anymore mm-hmm. if he wants to keep winning elections. So he is definitely trying to cater more towards this to at least get a land audit going that will keep him quiet for a while. But as this becomes more popular, I mean, within the next, it's hard to predict, but in the next near future, this land confiscation is something that he could really take off to become a really popular issue in South Africa, like it became in Zimbabwe 15 years ago, and then in even Kenya before that.
Well, the precedent is there, and you have the president of your country saying that, well, it's appropriate for blacks to confiscate white property without any compensation. That opens the door for very violent land grabs. How are the Afrikaners, the white South Africans, responding to this?
There's definitely a lot of concern. I've seen probably some of the more militant with the one organization here. I had their name, the Boer Afrikaner Volksraad, which is a group that has like 40,000 members. They've come out the strongest that said to actually do this would be in their mind a declaration of war. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of militias on the Afrikaner side as well that have kind of risen up in response to just like the slew of farm killings in the recent decades. I mean, I think it's since apartheid's ended, the white population in South Africa has gone down between 10% and 30%. A lot of it is due just like what they call like white flight, fleeing the country before things mm-hmm. get bad. But there's also been, I mean, thousands upon thousands of like white farmers who, even though the government's not confiscating land, have just been killed and had their land taken anyway, unofficially.
Extremely concerning story. We appreciate you bringing that to us, and do keep us up to date with what goes on there. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about where the money went that flooded into Iran after the nuclear deal lifted sanctions on that country. We'll talk about the threats America faces from cyber attacks, a diplomatic row between Germany and Turkey, and American police forces facing a recruitment shortage. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
One of the biggest stories from this past year was the nuclear deal struck with Iran and how this aided this terrorist sponsoring nation that's on the cusp of acquiring nuclear weapons. That deal flooded Iran with cash. And many in the West insisted this was going to help impoverished Iranians recover from the economic troubles that were brought about by sanctions against this country. Well, the Trumpet and many other observers said all along, that's not what that money is going to be used for. This week, a book was published that gives an inside look into just how true that was and really exposes quite a lot more than just that. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this book is entitled Iran, The Rise of the Revolutionary Guard's Financial Empire, and it details a number of startling statistics of how Iran has got its money and where they're spending it. The big part of the book talks about mainly how not just the military, not just religious affairs, but a lot of the commercial interests of Iran are under the direct control of the Ayatollah, Khamenei, and the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. We mention them a lot, but basically they are the private army or the private military of the supreme leader himself. They report directly to him. You have the Iranian military and the Iranian Navy all separate. They report directly to Khamenei. And what this book brings out, these members of this group have infiltrated a lot of the commercial ventures throughout throughout Iran, and they are getting a lot of money that way. But then it also talks about how much Iran has spent in the last couple of years on warfare, be it in Syria or elsewhere, exporting or buying up ballistic missiles from North Korea. It seems like one of their contentions is we claim that sanctions were burdening Iran so much that they groveled to the negotiating table to reach out to the West.
Right.
But really, they had money all along. They just weren't giving it to the people. They were spending it on their military. Mm. And now that the nuclear deal is in effect, they're on hyperdrive. Mm-hmm. They are spending defense spending right now is 30% of their budget, up from, I believe it was 17% a year earlier. So that's a 100% almost increase in a year that they're going to be spending on the military. This article brings out, the article's written by the Washington Times, but it's basically a book review. It says that Iran has spent $100 billion in the past 5 years financing operations in Syria. That's in the Syrian civil war, $100 billion. And they've paid nearly $100 million of that just to mercenaries, salaries of mercenaries to come and fight for them. And then it talks about how they've spent, on their ballistic missiles. They've spent $11 billion alone on intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're ones to try and reach across into the United States. So it's really just a startling book, because it shows that nuclear deal or not, Iran was on a course of military buildup, and the nuclear deal has only increased their defense spending.
So just one question. This book was released by the National Council of Resistance of Iran. This is a dissident group in Iran. Is there any doubt cast on the veracity of the information because of the source?
There would definitely be people that would come out and say that, yes, but I've read a lot of other books and documents and essays and research papers indicating similar things, especially of how deep the Ayatollah's control is over the whole financial system in Iran, and also how much of that money goes to military spending. I think mm-hmm. the Iranians themselves published that fact. Mm-hmm. They wanted everybody to know how much money was going towards the military. They published that fact, I think it was 3 weeks ago. So you can corroborate some of these facts with the Iranians themselves, but who else is going to dedicate so much resources to writing up this research? It would be a dissident group for sure that is upset with the way that their country has been taken over. Who would want to hide this fact? Maybe the Western powers that push so hard for the nuclear deal, because mm-hmm. it is blowing up in their faces. So I tend to believe, you know, this, judging from what's happening in the world and how much Iran's doing, I'll believe what this book says.
Thanks for that, Brent. There have been a lot of headlines recently about cyber attacks against America, especially from Russia. Well, the United States government's Defense Science Board Task Force on Cyber Deterrence has been hard at work for 2 years analyzing America's vulnerabilities to cyber attacks from other nations. They published their findings a couple of weeks ago, and there's real cause for concern here. To learn about this, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, both Russia and China now possess a capacity to carry out critical cyber attacks against foreign countries that is dangerously ahead of America's ability to defend against such attacks. So that's the assessment of this report. It's by the Defense Science Board and their Cyber Deterrence Task Force. As you said, this was based on a 2-year detailed analysis, and the report paints a really grim picture of American vulnerabilities. I'll just read one quote from the report here. It says, "The U.S. gains tremendous economic, social, and military advantages from cyberspace. However, our pursuit of these advantages has created extensive dependencies on highly vulnerable information technologies and industrial control systems. As a result, U.S. national security is at unacceptable and growing risk." So from there, the report lists a lot of major cyber attacks that America has already suffered, things like China's ongoing cyber theft of intellectual property from American companies, things like Russia's hacking and publishing of data from various American organizations in an effort to erode confidence in the U.S. political system. And this report says that these sorts of things are intentionally done to harm the U.S. That's easy enough to see. And they're just the tip of the iceberg for the sort of capacity that Russia and China have to carry out these kinds of things. Here's one more quote from the report. It says, "Russia and China have a significant and growing ability to hold U.S. critical infrastructure at risk via cyber attack. Both Russia and China have an increasing potential to also use cyber to thwart U.S. military responses to any such attacks. This emerging situation threatens to place the U.S. in an untenable strategic position." So the authors say that the U.S. is making some small progress in trying to reduce the pervasive cyber vulnerabilities of our critical infrastructure, but it says that the unfortunate reality is that for at least the next decade, the offensive cyber capabilities of countries like Russia and China will continue to far exceed America's ability to defend its critical infrastructure. So it really does paint quite a bleak picture there. And it brings to mind an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote all the way back in 1999. In that one, he identified America's cyber dependencies and its cyber vulnerabilities as the country's Achilles heel, a weak point that could easily be exploited by enemies. And now this report shows that Mr. Fleury's assessment all the way back in 1999 really was spot on, and it shows that America's Achilles heel is now more vulnerable than ever to attacks by Russia, China, and others. So for any listeners who haven't done so, I would just encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com. I think that article, America's Achilles Heel, is actually showcased on the front page right now because of its connection to a newer article that we have up there. So it's easy to spot, and I think it's an even more powerful read right now than when it was originally written.
It's amazing how much this is coming up in headlines recently. This report is being released just as allegations are coming out about vulnerabilities within the CIA and Russian attacks on the American political system and so on. It's definitely at top-tier headlines right now, but you have this sense that the worst is yet to come, don't you?
Very much so. And it's something that we often hear the warnings about it, but I guess it's easy to get a little bit lulled to sleep by them because the massive attack hasn't happened. So far, they've all been small and contained. But this report says that there's really not much that is preventing the big one from happening. So it's well, good to keep it in mind.
You even think about I guess it was last year that there were all of those records of government employees that were accessed, millions of records.
Yes.
And you do wonder if there might even be some of that has been used in ways that we wouldn't even be aware of.
That's true. One thing that this report brings out is that any attacks on military infrastructure would have been kept confidential. Hmm. So the U.S. public and the world wouldn't even know about it. So it is likely that all kinds of things are happening behind closed doors that authorities just don't want to disclose.
Thank you, Jeremiah. You're listening to our Week in Review on Trumpet Hour. This is 101.3 KPCG. During the migrant crisis that's been hitting Europe the past couple of years, one important player in the equation has been Turkey. This country has been able to absorb a lot of the immigrants coming from Syria and elsewhere. Europe has relied on this country to minimize the impact of this groundswell of migrants. But Turkey has been getting more authoritarian in recent years, and particularly over the past few months under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and it makes doing business with this country less and less inviting. This week, tensions between Turkey and Germany blew up. This could have some serious implications going forward. For this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
So this week, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he basically called the current German government a bunch of Nazis, which is not something that went down very well in Germany. But to just kind of go over how we got to this week, got to this point, I'll go back a few weeks. And as you said, Erdogan is becoming more and more authoritarian. He basically, anyone he doesn't like, he labels as a terrorist and then has them arrested, or not even arrested, just locked up and beaten. In this case, one of these people that he had locked up was Dengiz Yücel a few weeks ago, he has German citizenship, I believe, and he is a correspondent for Die Welt, a German newspaper. So he had him locked up. Then a couple of weeks later, he was charged and arrested. And this is not very popular at all in Germany. They had kind of, you know, free Deniz or free Yücel kind of protests and this kind of thing. And then something kind of suspicious happened towards the end of last week, beginning of this week. Turkey has a referendum coming up on April 16th and some changes to the constitution that would give more power to the presidency. And there's so many Turks living in Germany that Germany is actually a vital region for Turkish elections. It's effectively the fourth largest electoral district for Turkish elections, because of the number of Turkish citizens living in Germany that are eligible to vote. And so the Turkish government had a lot of people that were going to go to Germany and campaign and get people to try and vote yes in this referendum. And towards the end of last week, beginning of this week, a couple of German authorities shut down rallies and closed rallies. And on the surface, there's nothing to do with any kind of argument here, because this was German local authorities acting, not the German government. And they claimed that the reason for them closing these rallies down were things like double bookings or not enough parking spaces. But the timing does look very suspicious. Right. And so Turkey took that as or was very insulted by that, took that as the German government trying to interfere in this referendum.
And this is where you get Erdogan lecturing the Germans on the benefits of democracy.
Exactly. And that's where he blew up and called them Nazis, etc. And what I think is interesting is, you know, he was very extreme. You know, he said, if you keep stopping this, I'm going to come to Germany tomorrow and speak if I want to. And if you try and stop me, I'm going to start an insurrection against you. You know, very inflammatory language. But then you look at Angela Merkel's response, and it's just been, incredibly, incredibly mild. She said, well, there's no justification for being called Nazis, but she said, let us remember the special meaning of our close relationship and let cool heads prevail.
Yeah.
Now, she did come out a little more forcefully either today or yesterday, but I think this shows just the real dilemma that Angela Merkel is in right now. She's got two bad options. If she draws close to Erdogan, well, that's unpopular. Mm-hmm. You know, the German people don't want this Turkish thug to arrest whatever German journalist they like and there'd be no repercussions. So Angela Merkel drawing close to Erdogan makes her unpopular. At the same time, if she stands up to Erdogan in the way that a lot of the people want, well, then Erdogan could open the floodgates from Syria into Europe. I think there's around 3 million Syrian refugees in Turkey right now, and just bring the migrant crisis back worse than ever before. in the summer before the German election that could have major implications for that election, perhaps even torpedo Angela Merkel's re-election.
A lot of leverage there that Turkey has.
Exactly. And so neither option is really very appealing. And I think she's trying to kind of steer this fine line in between the two, where she kind of criticizes him just enough not to look too bad to people at home, while not criticizing him quite enough to annoy him. But you can certainly see why this is going to get Germany saying, OK, well, we need another solution to the migrant crisis. You know, we need to get more involved ourselves. We can't just hand the whole thing over to Turkey. And the way you see Russia trying to get involved as well, you know that Russia is probably going to be even worse in kind of using their leverage than Turkey is, especially the way they use pipelines and things like that. And so you can see how Germany's got to be thinking, well, we can't just sit back and let all these other countries gain all this leverage over us. We need to do something.
Well, have you thought about the implications in the longer term between Germany and Turkey? We've been watching this situation and the dependence that Germany has on Turkey, and we have this understanding that there is going to be some kind of alignment between Germany and Turkey. It's hard to see that happening with Erdogan taking the course that he is. Making Turkey more and more authoritarian and radical in a lot of ways. How do you think this is going to play out?
Yeah, it is interesting. I think even just look at the last year or so, where Turkey was very much anti-Russia, shot down a Russian jet, and now Erdogan and Putin are best buddies. So it is something that's very fluid and something that can change very quickly. There is that potential. I also think we can't rule out a leadership change in Turkey. It's certainly possible. I think somebody said that.
Well, they tried that. They tried that last year. That didn't go so
well. They did.
So well.
I did see someone saying, an article saying Erdogan's going down and he's trying to drag Merkel down with him. But the thing is, you know, just because it tried and failed last year, there have been a few times in history where there's been an attempted coup, there's been a harsh crackdown, and that harsh crackdown provoked an ultimately successful coup. And that was the end of Nero's reign, if I remember correctly. That, for some reason, that's the example that comes quickest to mind. I'm sure there's more recent ones.
That would definitely be electrifying if we did see something like that happen. Because watching this unfold, you would imagine that Germany tipped its hand and other nations did when that coup happened. There were quite a few people who were kind of rooting for those who wanted to get Erdogan out of there. I think it's almost made him that much more difficult to deal with when he saw just how much opposition he faced among these other leaders. But we'll keep our eyes on it. You had another point.
Yeah, well, I think things could change very quickly as well when Germany gets into the position where it's negotiating from a position of strength, like Russia is, rather than now when it's where it's acting from a position of weakness. Hmm. And just gaining more strength in the region, I think, could change the dynamic in that relationship very quickly as well.
We'll keep watching. Thanks for that, Richard. American law enforcement has had a lot of high-profile problems in recent years, allegations of racism, the police being under severe scrutiny for the way they handle certain situations, attacks on police increasing, even murders of some of our men in blue. New news emerged this week that, unsurprisingly, one of the effects of this trend is that fewer people want to become police officers. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, in some ways, it does almost seem like it's, I guess, to people's credit that it's taken this long for this trend to really set in. And the fact that you had like ambush style attacks on police doubled last year. There's been just a ton of really horrible anti-police rhetoric coming from organizations like Black Lives Matter and even from the previous president of the United States for the last several years. To where now they had one news report we were looking at, they had an officer from the Bowie, Maryland Police Department talking about how he used to get 200 to 300 applicants every time they held a training class. He said now he's lucky to get like a third of that.
Wow.
To get those in. And then we also had Bill Johnson, who's the executive director for the National Association of Police Organizations, came out, and he's this week he was talking. He said that hard statistics are still unavailable, But anecdotally, he said he keeps hearing more and more from local police chiefs just how hard it is to get people to sign up for the department. And he attributed that, similar as to we have, just to the increased dangers in America to being a police officer, and with the perception that elective leadership is not supportive. And I think just our last print edition of the Trumpet, we had a side article in there too about just like the increasing murder rate in all of America's big cities, and they've attributed that to many reasons, but in part, at least, the uptick in murders just to police being more reluctant to engage in high minority areas because of the public outcry they could get if anything goes wrong. Mm-hmm. And so this is just kind of an extension of that, with officers not wanting to even sign up in the first place.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting under Donald Trump, the man who has labeled himself the law and order president and has really come out in strong language supporting law enforcement in the United States, to see whether that trend might turn around. But we would expect, based on biblical prophecy, that that isn't going to turn around to any dramatic degree, the decline of America's law enforcement forces' ability to contain violence within the cities doesn't seem like that is going to turn around anytime soon.
Right. No. Yeah. Because it definitely, I think, I know over the course of Barack Obama's first term, that's the last term we actually have hard numbers for, is there's about 15,000 fewer police officers.
Wow.
And anecdotally, it seemed like probably the second term, when the government gets around to releasing that data, will probably be more than that. So it could be as high as 30,000 to 50,000 fewer officers nationwide. Now, that's offset by the fact that Barack Obama had hired up to like 80,000 federal police officers during his time in office. So we're now seeing something to where in 2000, American law enforcement was about 90% local, 10% federal. Now it's closer to about 75-25. Which is another trend coming out of this. Now, the Trump administration may turn this around of those two reasons. The increased dangers to police officers, unfortunately, is probably going to be something that's going to be with us for a while longer. Now, the elective leadership being unsupportive, maybe that may turn around. But you could see, the Trump administration has some big plans for cracking down on gangs and cracking down on drug cartels and tracking down on crime. Though sometimes when you do those things, those gangs and those cartels fight back. And so you could even see an increase in violence due to that as well.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. We have a revitalized website that we'd really like you to check out. And the stories that we talk about on the program today, we put up on the website. We'd like you to read them there in more detail. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists that's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week. We'll start with Richard.
The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker published a paper with five scenarios for the future of the European Union. Scenario 3 suggested a so-called two-speed Europe, where a core group of nations speed on and leave the rest behind. And since he published that, a lot of different EU leaders have been getting behind Scenario 3. European leaders will be meeting in Rome on March 25th, where they'll be discussing these scenarios. But it'll be very interesting to watch whether they get behind that. As we saw with the European military, 27 is just too big to get anything done, and more European leaders are seeing the need to shrink things down.
All right, let's go to Jeremiah.
This week, a key American ally refused to assign an ambassador to the United States, and that was the Philippines. President Rodrigo Duterte said, quote, "In the U.S., we have no ambassador, and no ambassador will go there. I don't feel like sending one," end quote. These are not the statements and actions of a willing ally, and it's just one more sobering indication of the weakening state of the system of U.S. alliances in Southeast Asia.
Over to Brent.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Thursday told Russian President Vladimir Putin that Israel opposes any settlement in Syria that retains an Iranian military presence in the country. He was talking to the press after his meeting with Putin in Moscow, and he said, quote, there can't be peace in Syria while the Iranians, quote, continue to make war. Mr. Netanyahu's comments come just a day after the United States ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, stated just about the same thing, that we have to make sure that in the end, Iran and its proxies are out of Syria. Now, given that Russia is searching for a strategy that will allow itself to integrate back into the world order, Russia might decide to choose to side with the West and help remove Iran from Syria.
And now to Andrew.
The number of illegal immigrants crossing into the United States has dropped 40% since President Donald Trump took office. According to Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, the number of illegals crossing into the United States has dropped from about 32,000 in January to less than 19,000 now.
All right, back to Richard.
The New York Times had an article on Monday where they said that European leaders are talking about coming up with a common European nuclear command. They said that European officials were putting together plans where France's nuclear arsenal would kind of be shared around and become Europe's nuclear umbrella. And so, you know, this is something we had in the latest Trump. It's been a huge, huge trend since Donald Trump became president, where Europe is putting much more stock in nuclear power, and Germany is looking at having nuclear power, which is what would in effect happen if they came up with this European nuclear command.
Amazing. Over to Jeremiah.
On Sunday, Japan's ruling Liberal Democratic Party announced that it would extend the term limits for its leader, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. This means Mr. Abe could soon be the longest-serving post-war leader in Japan. Abe has given Japan quite a lot of stability since he's been in office, so his party is eager to keep him there. But he's also been instrumental in dismantling the pacifism that's been a hallmark of Japan since World War II. So with 4 or 5 more years, he really could take some more really big steps toward continuing to remilitarize Japan.
All right, back to Brent.
Last week, the Islamic State discovered a palace of the ancient Assyrians underneath a blown-up shrine in the city of Mosul. Well, this week, archaeologists from Egypt and Germany have found an 8-meter or 26-feet statue submerged in groundwater in a Cairo slum that they say probably depicts the revered pharaoh Ramses II, who ruled Egypt more than 3,000 years ago. The discovery has been hailed by Egypt's Antiquities Ministry just this week as one of the most important ever, and was made near the ruins of Ramses II's temple, the ancient city of Heliopolis, located in the southeastern part of modern-day Cairo. On Thursday, archaeologists and officials and local residents could be seen looking at a massive forklift pull the statue's head out of the water. And if you haven't seen pictures of this, this is something that I definitely encourage you to do so.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
Well, in a sea change for American dietary practices, Americans now drink more bottled water than soda. 10 years ago, the average American drank a 50-gallon drum of soda every year.
Wow.
While only drinking about 27 gallons of bottled water. Whilst today, it's even Steven with drinking 39 gallons of soda and 39-gallon bottles of water each.
Oh, that's wonderful news. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com. We'll give you a subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, absolutely free. You can tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to all these gentlemen here with me, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
And our technical staff deserves some thanks as well, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Rudyard Kipling. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And what is more, you'll be a man, my son. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.